Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning and Happy New Year. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. We're going to spend this hour preparing for the new legislative session, the second year of this biennium. First, by speaking with the representatives of the Washington-Chittenden District, that includes Waterbury. At 9:30, WCAX Capitol Bureau Chief Calvin Cutler will be my guest, give us a wider view of this session. Then at 10 o'clock, Lisa Scalotti, editor of the Waterbury Roundabout, will join us for a look at the latest news from Waterbury. And at 10:30, we'll open up the phones and hear from you. Now, a little history. The Vermont legislature switched from a unicameral to a bicameral legislature in 1836. In 1915, it began meeting in January rather than opening the session in the fall, as it had done previously. Joining me now to discuss the upcoming session is State Representative Teresa Wood, who served in the legislature since being appointed in 2015. Representative Wood, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you, Rick. Glad to be here.
It's great to have you. We also have Representative Tom Stevens, first elected to his seat in 2008. Representative Stevens, great to have you back on the show as well.
Yeah, thanks, Rick. I appreciate your time.
You're welcome. Listeners, if you'd like to ask our guests a question, you can give us a call, 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255, or you can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. This is for both of you. It was almost a year ago when you were both on with me just as the COVID vaccine had been released. Optimistically, I think we would have thought we would have been putting COVID in our rearview mirror, if not for the Delta, the Omicron variants. Now with record case counts, Teresa Wood, what are your thoughts on what the state should be doing?
Well, it's a complicated subject, as we all know, and frankly, I wish we had more of a statewide mask mandate. I think that we are seeing people, I know in my limited time out and about over the last week and a half or so, I'm seeing more and more people wear their masks, which I think is critical, and for those people who are unvaccinated to get vaccinated, because we are seeing, you know, those folks are having an impact on the healthcare system, and our healthcare systems are stretched right now. So, you know, it sounds like a broken record, but get vaccinated and wear your mask.
Tom Stevens, your thoughts?
Well, I think masking is really the least that we can all do for each other. I mean, I think the point that we made a year ago, not we, but the CDC and everybody else who was beginning to learn how to deal with the pandemic, was that I'm wearing a mask to help protect other people. And I think that, to me, is really the least we can do. I think, you know, I mean, those of us who have been vaccinated and boosted have some more protection. Omicron is getting beyond those protections a little bit, but you know, the symptoms seem to be much less overall. But I think it's really hard, as Teresa said, it's really complicated, because there's this urge to want to be back to normal now after almost 2 years, and to do the things that we've done after 2 years of really paying attention to this. And so the baseline for us is, you know, get vaccinated, get boosted, wear a mask, and really limit your time out in crowds. I mean, those are really the things that can help prevent the spread. We have to continue to have patience in dealing with this. Again, no one has been able to deal with a pandemic of this size ever, you know, in our lifetimes. And so it's an incredible learning experience every day.
Yeah.
But, you know, the basic things are still probably the best things that we can do.
I don't think I've been this well behaved for this long ever in my entire life. So, but we persevere. Tom Stevens, there will be ARPA infrastructure money to be distributed during this session. What are the areas where you think these funds should be allocated?
Well, there's so many different resources even just now. I think we're going to see a lot of money come to Vermont through the transportation and infrastructure bill that was passed earlier this fall. And that's going to provide some really key infrastructure money over and above what we receive on an annual basis from the federal government, from the federal highway programs. And but the ARPA money, we still have, for instance, coming out of our interest in the housing committee, there's still close to over $150 million of ARPA money put aside to be spent over the next couple of years on new housing. Mm-hmm. And, how we're able to do that over that time period is really what we're going to be focusing on. But there's an opportunity here. And it's really a balanced opportunity, I think, and I think we have to be careful about raising hopes up about exactly how high these opportunities could be, when in fact they're going to take some time to get there. But this money, this federal money that's coming, is giving us some real opportunities to do things that we have never been able to do in the past, including building housing for people so that we can try to really limit homelessness, for instance, or to try to provide programming so that those who need the social safety net have one. And so we're going to be working really hard in determining how that can work, how that can be built over the next couple of years with this federal money, with the caveat that we have to create programs that we can then sustain with. At some point, federal dollars will more than likely dissipate. And we really need to plan for that. So there's a lot of good things that can happen with this ARPA money, and I know that the appropriations committees and in both the House and Senate have been meeting throughout the fall to just try to get a handle on how we can spend it.
Teresa Wood, your thoughts on the additional federal funds?
Well, I think that one of the key things that are facing pretty much every sector in the state is workforce and workforce shortages. And whatever we can do with these additional funds that will help increase the accessibility of high-quality childcare, of services for people with mental health issues or people with disabilities or our older Vermonters, our nursing homes and long-term care facilities, they're experiencing staff shortages like you've never really seen before. Recently, we had a family member receiving services in a long-term care facility, and we've all heard of traveling nurses and the huge price that we really pay for traveling nurses. But we're not just hiring traveling nurses now; we're hiring traveling LNAs, nursing assistants, and those dollars are essentially, leaving Vermont, and we need those dollars to be in Vermont, and we need a workforce that can come back stronger. I mean, we've lost thousands of workers in our workforce since the pandemic began, and we had a worker crisis before the pandemic began. So, right. We hope in our committee to really be focusing on things that will improve the access for long-term services and supports and health care, child care, and those critical services for Vermonters.
Another big issue facing the legislature will be the major shortfall in the state's pension funds. Tom Stevens, in the long run, how do we address that shortfall?
Well, I'm still anxious to hear what the committee, the summer group that has been meeting many, many hours between June and recently. I have not seen the results of their reports yet, of their study yet, but it is, as baby boomers age, I was born in 1961. I'm 60 now. So everybody above me, I guess the baby boom ended in 63 or 64. So you're talking about people who are ready to retire, and it's a huge bubble of people, and we really need to be able to make sure that the fixes that we propose are sustainable, that the next generation of people 10 years from now, 20 years from now, 30 years from now have a strong pension system as well. But it is, the threat here is that if, you know, as people retire, and they will be bunching up just because of age, that we don't stress the system. I mean, we had a good year of returns this year, but I'm really anxious to see what the report says and to see what the stakeholders came to this year, this past summer and fall, because it's really important to get this right in the short term, in order to build up for retirees, you know, people who are just entering the teaching system and the state employee system now, should have the same opportunities to plan for their retirement as people have had for the last 30 or 40 years. But there's a deep problem here that I'm hoping that we find a way to get through it without too much pain for people.
Well, Teresa Wood, have we reached that point where we need to alter the benefits paid out in for these state pensions, at the very least, to those who are now entering the workforce?
Well, I think that the solution to this is going to be multifaceted. And one of the things that, you know, that we continually hear as legislators is that people don't want their benefits sort of messed with, you know. And
right.
What we're trying to do is to ensure that there is a benefit, So I expect that any kind of solution, and I sort of even hesitate to use that word solution, because it's an ongoing iterative process. And I think that we sort of fool ourselves into thinking that, okay, we take, you know, a particular action and, okay, now we've solved the problem and we just go about our business. Well, demographics change, cost of living changes, the age when people retire changes. It's a fluid, the investments, the return on investments definitely are fluctuate. All of these things influence what benefits can be paid out, what contributions people have to make, what contributions we as taxpayers make towards these systems. So I think that the thing that we sort of have to get away from is thinking that, okay, we take a particular action, you know, whether it's in this legislative session or the next, or, you know, whenever it happens to be, we take a particular legislative action and we fixed it. That's not going to be the case. This has to be a process that is reviewed, continually, and, you know, not just by the investment boards, but by the legislature on, really on an annual basis. And that we have to make adjustments, and that might mean adjustments for people receiving benefits. It might mean adjustments for what we put into the system, within the state's budget, and it might mean adjustments for employers, on the employer side of things. So I think that we have to be aware that it's going to take a lot of different pieces to put this puzzle back together again. A
couple notes about our guest upon her retirement from the state service. The Teresa Wood Citizenship Award was created. It's an award given out yearly to a person with developmental disabilities who embodies Teresa's qualities. And Tom Stevens has served as executive director of the Vermont Alliance for Arts Education, and in 2008 recorded the audiobook version of Archer Mayer's Open Season. Archer Mayer, a favorite of ours here at Vermont Viewpoint. Listeners, to ask our guests a question, you can call 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Teresa Wood, the state colleges will be merged into a single entity, Vermont State University, with various campuses in Castleton, Linden, Johnson, Randolph. What's your assessment of this move, and is it enough to save our state colleges system?
Well, I think without it, it would have been difficult to save our state colleges system. I think it is a move that is necessary, even though I really can appreciate, particularly the folks at Castleton, who really have, I would say, reinvented themselves down there, and had really come into this position strong. But they, you know, were part of an overall system, and I think it's going to be necessary. And I think, honestly, we have to go a step further than what happened in Lyndon and Johnson. You know, there was a lot of, you know, name changes and things like that. But, you know, essentially, to the outside viewer, it didn't look like there were a huge number of changes when that quote-unquote merger happened. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, what we're talking about here is really a reinvention of the state college system, which I think is necessary given the times that we're in. I mean, we have to look at, we have thousands of fewer students from which, you know, people to try to attract to our colleges and universities. We saw over the last couple of years several Vermont colleges fold. And in order to not have that happen to our state college system, I think we needed bold action. And I feel like this is bold action. And we will see over the next few years how it produces results. But we also, as a state, need to be prepared to put more into our state college system and the University of Vermont, frankly. You know, I think people have heard the data on this, but, you know, we are in the bottom tier of state support for our state colleges and universities. And that's something that it needs real adjustment, in my opinion. And that means that we need to take a hard look at that. But, yes, I think this is something that was needed, and we'll have to see if it produces the results that we hope.
Tom Stevens, is it the right move, and how important is it to keep universities in Lyndon and Johnson?
Oh, I think it's an incredibly – I think it is the right move. It's incredibly important. The Vermont City College's population is made up almost – primarily of Vermonters, and I think we have to remember that this is a state college system that is, you know, I think it's over 85% of the students come from Vermont. It's quite different from UVM or any of the private colleges in the state, and so to service the people that we are residents, you know, our young adults, it's really important to try to keep this system going and to try to fund it at a level that it can, again, that it can be sustained. You know, we stopped funding it at that level many years ago, before our time in the legislature, and it's been very difficult to get back to that level of funding. And so what they're proposing, I'm hoping provides a unified vision for those campuses, and so that we can provide, you know, we can tell Vermont students that this is the place to be where you'll get really solid learning in fields that mean something to you, and then if you're interested in how that equates into work, that we have those programs in place, and that we can make it affordable. College is yet another expense that has become very expensive for young people to carry, you know, a debt load later on in life, and our state colleges are not immune to that. The kids who go there don't receive as much financial aid as they might elsewhere because there's just not enough backing. And then carrying the debt after paying for this college, it's just as stressful as if you go anyplace else. So if we can stabilize the foundation of the administration of those colleges in a way that allows the learning to happen at a more affordable place for our students and their families, I think that would be a huge step forward for this organization. It's really important that we get there because it's we need to have kids educated in the fields they want to go into, whether it is something as basic as LNA to nursing, to construction, to all forms of the workforce where we see that there are gaps.
We got about 2 minutes left, so a minute each from you on this. But lack of universal high-speed internet been a major problem in the state. Of course, this ties right into a workforce problem. Tom Stevens, what do we need to do this session to help alleviate this problem throughout the state?
I think we've started that again, Rick. I think we have more money coming to us that's been allocated. We have a system that's been set up after the last session where there are community utility districts have been set up where people are trying to work together at a very, very local level to determine what their needs are. I mean, here in Bolton, next door to us, we are just signed a letter, Teresa and I and the state senators in Chittenden County just signed a letter to promote their application for increased broadband in Bolton, which is very difficult because it's a very high square mileage town with lots of mountains in it. And they're working really hard to get this. And the communities across the state are doing so. There's money available. There's money going to be spent. The state just purchased miles and miles and miles of fiber to provide, to lay down to these communities. And I'm hoping again in the next 2 years we'll see an incredible increase in broadband availability and at an affordable price.
Teresa Wood, last word. What would you personally hope to see get past this session?
Well, one thing that we haven't talked about, Rick, is reapportionment. And that is going to have has the potential to have a dramatic impact on who people vote for and what districts are being represented when people vote this coming November. So that will be taking up a significant portion of the legislature's time. The apportionment board has made their recommendations on a 4-3 vote. So it's definitely got room for, there's room for changes there. And the House will be reviewing the House proposal. The Senate will be reviewing the Senate proposal that was made by the apportionment board. There are changes recommended in both of those proposals for our district, and so people should be paying attention to that.
Excellent. Teresa Wood, Tom Stevens, representatives for the Washington Chittenden District. I want to thank you both for your time again. It's great having you on. Have a great session.
Thank you, Rick.
Thank you for having us on.
Absolutely. We're going to take a break for a CBS News update, and then we'll return to talk with Calvin Cutler of WCAX. And today at 1 o'clock, Charlie Papillo joins us for Travels with Charlie, followed by 2 hours of The Getaway with the gregarious Greg Hooker. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Warren Village is a picture-perfect snow globe this time of year. We invite you to visit us at the almost world-famous Warren store. Come for breakfast, lunch, or après-ski. Have a signature deli sandwich, a hearty soup, or a specialty coffee drink paired with a sweet treat from our incredible bakery. Upstairs is a cornucopia of delightful and unique finds from men's, women's, and children's clothing to gifts, toys, games, jewelry, hats, gloves, and scarves. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, according to Yankee Magazine. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Sengary. As regular listeners know, I like to end the week with a call to national correspondent Bob Ney to get a look at the national and international news. Now we're going to start our week during the legislative session with a check-in with WCAX Capitol Bureau Chief Calvin Cutler. He joins us now to get us ready for the new session. Calvin, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you, Rick. Good to be here.
It's great having you. Listeners, to ask Calvin a question about the new session, you can give us a call at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255, or email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Calvin, just bullet point and give us a list of the top issues that you see the legislature addressing this session.
Yeah, I mean, right off the top, I think the infrastructure plan, $2.2 billion that Vermont is getting, they have to figure out how to use that, plus another $600 million in American Rescue Plan funds. Certainly, there's the $3 billion pension shortfall that, that lawmakers have to contend with, and also reapportionment as well, and climate council proposals that were pitched a few weeks ago, along with some pandemic policies as well. So there certainly is, there's a lot of work that lawmakers have to do this coming session.
Boy, if we just added up the $2.2 billion infrastructure, $600 million ARPA, that's $2.8 billion. We could wipe out, just about wipe out that pension deficit and save a few hundred million a year, I think, on interest and then use that for something. But that's not the way it works, does it, Calvin?
No, it's unfortunately not. Certainly, there's certain pots of money go to certain things. I mean, $2.2 billion, though, is a lot. I mean, it's really, you know, anybody you talk to within the legislature or state government, they'll tell you it is going to be transformational,
yeah,
especially for roads and bridges and broadband, too.
Yeah, and all those things needed. I'm not making light of how important some of the things we've had to kind of put off as far as infrastructure could be addressed now, and it really does finally make sense. What do we know about this session, how it'll be conducted live or Memorex, in person or via Zoom?
Yeah, that's been one of the biggest questions, really, that top lawmakers have been kind of wrestling with the past few weeks of, you know, how to hold this legislative session during, you know, the Delta surge, but also the Omicron surge as well, and also what it means for public access and transparency. So right now the plan is the session is going to be remote for the first 2 weeks. House and Senate lawmakers are going to be meeting again over Zoom, and all of their meetings are going to be, you know, streamed over YouTube. And, you know, there's a number of factors as to why that decision was made. But I guess the first one being, you know, there's questions of what would happen if a lawmaker would get sick or had to quarantine, and potentially, especially in smaller Senate committees, they might not be able to draw a quorum, meaning a majority of lawmakers, and they wouldn't actually be able to legislate. So there's that. But then there's also, you know, if you've ever been in the state house during, you know, winter sessions, you know, people are packed in really small committee rooms.
Yeah.
And you know, there's always a bug that goes around the state house. And certainly nobody wants anybody to get sick, especially there's a lot of unknown still with Omicron. So everybody, they're just asking for flexibility for the first 2 weeks of the session. And they're going to continue to reevaluate.
You talked about public access. How different is it, Calvin, covering a legislative session virtually as opposed to in person?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely got pluses and minuses, right? I mean, part of the beauty of the state house and the legislative session is being able to pull lawmakers aside normally out into the hallway or track them down in the cafeteria and be able to ask them questions and clarify and chat with them. But that access is tough over Zoom because, you know, people are in committee hearings all day, and then maybe they need to go and stretch their legs and walk away from their computer for a bit. So there's that negative side of it. But then also on the silver lining to all of it, too, you know, we've got these committee meetings that are being live streamed to every single corner of the state, and people can also Zoom to log in and testify in front of lawmakers from any corner as well. So really, it's in a big way, it's certainly expanded the democratic process and has really made it a lot more transparent for Vermonters too. So that element of the lawmaking, I'm told, live streaming committee meetings, that's here to stay for the long term.
And we should give a nod to that state house cafeteria, serve up good food, and there's probably more deals get done sitting there at that cafeteria and at those tables than anywhere else in the state. So too bad that's going to be on hold for at least two more weeks. How does what, you know, gets debated and passed in the second year of a biennium differ from what happens in that first year?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, normally the first year of the biennium is when all of the bills are getting written and people are, you know, newer members are kind of getting their sea legs. And that's kind of the introductory, if you will, phase of the biennium. And then they introduce those bills and those issues. And then normally the more politically challenging and tougher measures, those at times get sort of pushed to the second year of the biennium. I mean, you look at some of the policies that we're going to be tackling this year, like education finance reform and the pupil waiting report. Certainly there's a lot there. Also the pension issue that got pushed to a summer study committee, and lawmakers are going to be debating that this year this coming session as well. So a lot of the beefier, meatier issues, you know, really get tackled in the second year of the session. But in part, that's just because, you know, some of these issues, they do take multiple years. And some of them, they may get pushed to another session. I guess we'll just have to see what the workflow will be and what lawmakers can accomplish while doing this remote Zoom hybrid format. So it'll be interesting to see.
And, of course, the second year of the session has you passing those more controversial laws right before you have to be reelected. So that makes it even more exciting. All right, let's take a deeper look at some of the things you mentioned. Just talked about pupil weighting. This has nothing to do with how much pupils weigh, but this is really important as far as financing our education system.
It is, and this is probably one of the most consequential policies really that lawmakers will be taking up this session. And without getting too into the weeds, but basically the state distributes money to towns and to schools based on criteria, you know, including the number of students and their characteristics in a per pupil system. So it takes into account like the poverty rate and where students live in the state and rural versus urban. And it assigns them certain weights. But there was a study that was done a couple of years ago, and it showed that the weights were really, really incongruent with the reality of the situation, and that lower income and disadvantaged districts were not getting their fair shake. So now lawmakers are trying to go back and look at how do we better fund schools and give all kids the same opportunity. And this one it's politically tricky because it could potentially mean that some districts may lose out on money where other districts gain money too. And so there was a summer study committee that put together a few recommendations about direct grants and categorical aid versus changing the weights. So we'll have to see what ultimately lawmakers will decide with that issue. But there's it's a really tricky topic because education finance in Vermont is no easy task.
Yeah, we've been trying to get our arms around this for session after session, and we'll see how this goes. Have you heard any feedback yet from legislators about that summer committee report?
Yeah, I think, you know, from lawmakers, I think they were really trying to take their time and do their due diligence and hear as much testimony as they could. I mean, they met over a dozen times, and some of these meetings were marathon meetings. They heard lots of public comments. And really the biggest change right now is they're going to be introducing direct grants, or proposed grants, I should say, to English language learners in districts. And that, of course, has some advocates for changing the weights for everybody, that has them bristling, really, because they say that these grants won't go far enough and that those could change from year to year, depending on the state budget or the appropriation of the time and whoever's in the legislature or the executive branch. So that's really been kind of the biggest feedback that we've heard so far. But in terms of, you know, how lawmakers contend or will, you know, debate this, I think that certainly remains to be seen, but it will be a lively debate, definitely.
Indeed. Now, let's talk about that big cash you talked about earlier, $2.2 billion in infrastructure cash. What are some key areas being looked at for these funds?
Yeah, I mean, it's really all over. I mean, roads, bridges, broadband, water, sewer, lake cleanup for Lake Champlain, Lake Memphremagog, and also our waterways, and big investments in public transportation too, specifically electrification and EVs. You know, the way that the money flows here, it gets paid out over the next 5 years, or every 5 years, I should say, the transportation bill. So certainly there's some time to spend this money and to work it out, but really, I think the biggest challenge that I've been hearing from legislators and from, you know, people boots on the ground, really, who are involved with this work is the workforce challenges and trying to find contractors to build all of these projects in the next 5 years. That's definitely going to be a challenge.
Well, it certainly will stimulate the economy. It probably means we'll be down to one lane of traffic in certain situations again, kind of like when that Tiger money came through several years back. You know, that is the flip side of it. Now, the $600 million that we get for ARPA funds, that money has to be used differently. How's that work out?
Yeah, so there's a little more flexibility with this money. This, as you know, was part of the American Rescue Plan Act, which was passed last winter. Last session, we used about half of it, about $600 to $700 million, on workforce and broadband and really recovery grants, all sorts of uses. And for this $600 million, we still have some time left. We've got about another 2 or so years to spend it. And as I mentioned, they're really there aren't many restrictions on this cash. There's some, but you can use it broadly for, childcare grants. You can use it for broadband, workforce. There's really, the sky is the limit in terms of what you can use this money for. But, Governor Scott, we heard him say last session, and probably this session we're going to hear it too, is he warned lawmakers about using this money to create new programs that will require yearly investments, right, or appropriations. And that was one of his biggest concerns. But, ultimately, though, this money helped smooth out disagreements between the legislative and executive branch last session. And it was a pretty smooth session, all things considered. So I think we'll have to see whether that plays out the same way this coming session.
All right. We're in a deep hole when it comes to funding the pensions, state pensions, and you've already vetoed my idea of using all the infrastructure and ARPA money to get us to zero on that. Can you give us a quick recap how we got $3 billion in the hole here?
Yeah, I mean, it's really been happening. It's been happening for many decades. But in short, it's a combination of factors, including lower than anticipated return on investments, chronic underfunding back in the early 1990s, and then, of course, our demographics as well. Retirees are living longer and using more benefits in the system, which, certainly we want people to live longer, but those three factors have really kind of made this $3 billion shortfall. As you may remember, House lawmakers last session, they pitched a plan to shore up the funds, but it really it cut back a lot of benefits for state employees and for teachers, and they did not like it. I mean, there was vocal outcry last session, and so lawmakers rescinded that plan, and then they've had a summer study committee, and really they've been hashing it out all summer, just like the pupil waiting report. They've been meeting weekly to try to understand, how do we solve this systemic issue? And, they're just wrapping up actually their work this week. They've got, I think, one or two more meetings, but their plan is likely going to include something having to do with, either cutting benefits or raising revenues or some combination of the two. Certainly unions and progressives in the legislature, they've called for a tax on the top earners in Vermont to try to stabilize the fund. So again, this is one of those really politically tricky issues that, as we mentioned, gets pushed to the second year of the biennium just because it's so complex.
Yeah, addressing it seems to be kind of a poison chalice. I know Treasurer Beth Pierce has attempted it. House Speaker Jill Krawinski tried to tackle it and then backed off last year. So we'll see what happens. But it does need to be addressed. Kicking this can down the road does not make it any better. Actually, it gets worse and worse. All right, next one, Cannabis Control Board. They've had recommendations on tax and fees for the controlled sale of marijuana. So what needs to be decided and how quickly with this one?
Yeah, I mean, this one, the Cannabis Control Board, they've been coming up with rules and regulations of how our new legal retail marijuana marketplace is going to work. And essentially, a couple of weeks ago, they forwarded five recommendations to lawmakers having to do with, who can grow, when and where, and how many licenses will be given out. Mm-hmm. And what will it be taxed, and what fees will be associated with you know, retail and growing licenses as well. So, you know, committees of jurisdiction within the State House, they have to take a look at that and vote on that. But licenses to grow, those are still slated to come out this spring, and licenses to sell are still slated to come out in the early fall. So sales are still on track for October of this coming year. But, you know, I think it's worth, you know, pointing out just the you know, mammoth task of setting this market up. Yeah. The Cannabis Control Board, it's just three people plus a staff member or two. And they've heard hundreds of hours of public comments and testimony from, you know, people all across Vermont. And really the number one goal that they have is to try to bring as much of the illicit marijuana marketplace into the light and to regulate it. We get revenue from it, and also it's safer as well. So there's still a lot of work that has to be done, but most of that work now kind of falls within the State House.
We're just scratching the surface of all the issues that'll be taken on this session. Just gives you an idea of how much a citizen legislature, the work they have to do in a short amount of time each year. We have about 2 minutes left. Let's talk a little politics with Senator Leahy retiring, with the decision of Congressman Welch running for Senate. We've heard the announced candidacies of Lieutenant Governor Molly Gray, Senate President Becca Bayland. How's that going to influence the legislative session?
Yeah, I mean, if it wasn't a busy enough session, you know, already with all of these policies, I mean, you mentioned earlier that, you know, all of this, it's happening in an election year, too. So we've got all of those candidates that you named, but then also just people in general, you know, making their bid for office. Certainly, I think, you know, all eyes are going to be on the Senate with Molly Gray, Lieutenant Governor, who presides over the Senate, and then Senate Pro Tem, President Pro Tem Becca Ballant, you know, leading in the Senate and, you know, really kind of being the voice of policy there. I think that a lot of people are going to be looking and trying to observe the relationship between the two. But, you know, both Lieutenant Governor Gray and Becca Ballant have said that, you know, legislating and moving some of this federal cash and, you know, tackling really the policies, that's their number one priority, is to do their job. You know, certainly the pandemic and the remote nature of the State House, I think that gives more opportunities for them to be able to, you know, hold, you know, roundtables or meet and greets or Zoom happy hours and campaign rallies, you know, from their homes instead of, you know, having to drive all over the state. So there could be a little more flexibility there in terms of how they actually campaign while during the session. Normally that would all have to wait until after May. So I think it's going to be really interesting to see. It certainly, you know, the two candidates we mentioned, but all lawmakers really have a lot on their plate this session.
All right, got about 10 seconds, Calvin. Governor Scott has decided to run again for governor. Anybody on the progressive or Democratic side to oppose him yet?
Not that I've heard of yet. You know, that's not to say somebody couldn't come out of the woodwork, but yeah, certainly it would be the governor is popular, and so I think it'll be interesting to see.
Yeah. Calvin Cutler is the WCAX Capital Bureau Chief. Calvin, thank you for joining us this morning. I really look forward to hearing from you every Monday morning with a primer on what to expect each week at the State House. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Rick. I really appreciate it.
All right. Top of the hour news next, and we return to speak with another member of the media when Lisa Scalodi of the Waterbury Roundabout joins us. Coming up this morning at 11, we've got Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Warren Village is a picture-perfect snow globe this time of year. We invite you to visit us at the almost world-famous Warren store. Come for breakfast, lunch, or après-ski. Have a signature deli sandwich, a hearty soup, or a specialty coffee drink paired with a sweet treat from our incredible bakery. Upstairs is a cornucopia of delightful and unique finds from men's, women's, and children's clothing to gifts, toys, games, jewelry, hats, gloves, and scarves. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, according to Yankee Magazine. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. Earlier this morning, we heard from the state representatives for the Waterbury area, Teresa Wood and Tom Stevens. It's time now to hear more about what's happening in town from the digital news source covering Waterbury. Joining me is the editor of the Waterbury Roundabout, Lisa Scalotti. Lisa, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Good morning, Rick. Thanks for having me today. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Listeners, to ask Lisa a question or to share a comment, you can call us at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. The email address, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Lisa, give us a little history of the Waterbury Roundabout.
Well, let's see. It's really only been a year and a half, although I think the last year and a half has feels a lot longer for all of us, right?
Yeah.
So the Waterbury Roundabout came about in May of 2020. And back in March was when the Waterbury Record, which had been our weekly newspaper for something like 13 years, the owners of the Waterbury Record closed it soon after the pandemic shutdown began. I remember back in mid-March of 2020, the group in Stowe that published the Waterbury Record had six newspapers, and just like every other newspaper organization out there, they had to make a bunch of adjustments, and they decided to close one of the papers, and it was the Waterbury paper that they closed. But it was a bad time for us to be without local news, right? And at the time, I had been working with that group previously as an editor at a couple of their papers and had started working at UVM in 2019 with a new program there that I helped launch called Community News Service, and it's an internship program with University of Vermont students who are interested in journalism, who are learning to do community news reporting and supplying stories to local weekly papers mostly. And at the time, we thought, you know, we kind of put our heads together and said, why can't we turn some of this energy that we've got here to covering news in Waterbury? So it kind of started off as a class project, essentially.
Wow.
And we had a student on our team who was really good with digital stuff, and she created the website. And we just kind of dove in without really thinking too much about it, I suppose, and just started covering news in Waterbury. And the website went live in May of 2020.
And how has it grown in that time, in that year and a half?
It's been really cool to watch. We've continued to work with the university, with the students every semester. So that's been really helpful to have them on board doing stories and also teaching them along the way how to cover local news. And we've had, you know, we've got a couple different formats right now.
Yeah.
Our website is out there, and we have a Facebook page that we use pretty often to get our stories out there into the community. And we do an email once a week that we've seen grow now. We've got over 1,700 people on our list that get our email once a week that has, like, sort of the digest of the weekly news stories. But one interesting thing that's happened that I think has been really cool to see is just the collaborations that we've been able to pull together. Besides just the university piece with the students helping us supply and cover news, we're working with other news organizations to, you know, do what we do. You know, we've got a couple really important partnerships with the Times Argus and with VT Digger. You've probably seen it, but we've managed to return a print newspaper to our community.
I love that.
Right? It's called the Waterbury Reader, and the folks at the Times Argus in late 2020, sort of the fall of 2020, were looking to do sort of a community print product that was going to come out into central Vermont, themselves trying to sort of, you know, pivot during the pandemic as well to reach more people. And they saw what we were doing with local news online, and they asked us if we would help by supplying stories to go into a local version of this weekly, and they decided to call it Waterbury Reader. They have a Central Vermont Reader, too, that circulates in the rest of sort of Washington and Orange counties, I think. But that was a great way for us to answer the question that everybody was asking us was, we like this website, but what about a paper? When can you give us a paper back? And that was, you know, we knew that people really liked having a physical newspaper, but it seemed sort of a daunting thing. And obviously the Waterbury Record folks chose to stop it. So that's been really nice for us to be able to have our stories that we have on our website that we also send over to the Times Argus every week. Gordon Miller, who's my partner in this, local photographer, freelance photojournalist, and his pictures get a nice ride in that every week. And so that lands in everybody's mailboxes for free in the Waterbury zip codes. And you see it in town. It's at like the, you know, convenience stores and markets and pharmacy and the town offices, et cetera.
All right.
So that's been an important partnership. And then this past summer, we had an important thing fall into place with the folks at VT Digger, where the board of their nonprofit that sort of is their parent organization called Vermont Journalism Trust, they decided and agreed to become our fiscal sponsor. So we've kind of registered with the state as a Vermont nonprofit corporation, but we don't have federal 501c3 status yet. But their organization, that's their parent organization, does. And so they've basically agreed to kind of be our parent nonprofit to kind of help us get on our feet financially that way. So that helps us in terms of they're not funding us in any way, but they're helping us so that when we do fundraising, it goes through their nonprofit. So people who contribute to us, we could also seek grants that need a 501c3 status, and it could potentially be tax deductible for people to give to us. So that's an important piece to come into place as well, too.
WaterburyRoundabout.org is where you can go read the stories, sign up for the email newsletter. Lisa, what do you think the students who've been involved with the Roundabout are gaining from this experience?
Oh, you know, it's been really great to have them be part of this. You know, in the beginning, we were sort of just sending the stories off to other newspapers, but to have it be the thing that we're producing here and to be sort of, you know, kind of directing that has been really fun. It's gotten a little bit better in the last, you know, sort of go around the last semester where the students have been able to come here and work in person more. Earlier in the pandemic, it was difficult because they were doing a lot of remote reporting. They weren't really, we weren't really allowed to have them go out and about in the community during the sort of the stay home, stay safe era. But, you know, a lot of professional journalists have been working that way, too. So they've you know, their experience hasn't been that much different. But it's with this past semester, we had a student from St. Michael's, actually, who was part of the UVM internship program. And she spent a bunch of time in Waterbury covering stories. Her name was Megan Schneider. And she came and covered a whole bunch of stories here in Waterbury from some features. She covered the school board. The school bond vote back in November, and she was here and did a really nice feature on the River of Light parade. But it was really cool to see her come and meet people and do reporting in person and make those connections and sort of then see the, you know, the feedback that she would get on her stories when people would, you know, share things and comment on them on Facebook and on the website. And I think it's a really good first-hand taste that they get to see the impact that they could have by covering local news and, you know, meeting real people and knowing that people, you know, are getting this in their house every week and they're reading it, and it's informing people. I think that's a really cool connection to see happening.
It sure is. All right, let's talk about one of the biggest stories in the state over the past few weeks. Been these scary COVID case numbers. Waterbury certainly has had its share of cases. So what's been happening here in Waterbury?
Boy, Waterbury has sort of a dubious distinction after the last round of numbers came out last week. The state Department of Health once a week puts out numbers that are community specific, showing how many new cases were reported in that community that they're keeping track of. And this past week, their data goes through Wednesdays. So the data that went through last Wednesday, December 29th, showed that Waterbury logged 130 cases in just the prior 7 days. And so for Waterbury, that was the biggest week of the pandemic. Previously, the highest number that we had was 41, and that was just the week before. Before that, it was 29. So we're, you know, what's happening here is pretty much, you know, the same story that's happening across the state and across the country, where the community spread has really exploded with this new variant that we're seeing, this Omicron variant, since Thanksgiving time. And so, you know, and we think that that number is sort of a conservative number. It's the people who are testing. It's the people who are reporting. And so, you know, like everyone else, I'm kind of refreshing my computer this morning looking to see what the new numbers are going to be, because there hasn't been any reporting since Thursday by the state, given the holiday. So we're curious to see where those numbers are headed. But it's definitely had an impact on our schools. And up until Thanksgiving, I think the school district here, Harwood, has been doing a good job of, you know, they have a mask rule within all the schools where all the students and staff are masked all the time. There were cases popping up, and it seemed as if every time a case would pop up, they would do the contact tracing they needed and, you know, test the kids that are, you know, the people that would be involved in that one, you know, cluster, and they wouldn't find more cases. So there were just sort of these one-off cases, one here, one there, and that was, you know, relatively contained. But boy, right before the Christmas break, it just started popping. Our emails were just buzzing. Every couple days, there was, you know, three emails, four emails. And by the time the last day of school came before Christmas break, Brookside Primary School, just up the street there from your studio, didn't have enough staff to open. So they started their Christmas holiday break a day early because they weren't able to open the school.
Oh, my. And the numbers you were talking about from last Thursday, really not impacted yet by the Christmas and New Year's holidays. So I would expect over the next several weeks, we might be setting new records here in Waterbury.
We got an email yesterday or over the weekend from the school district saying that just over the holiday break, they had 44 new cases reported just by families reporting in, checking in with the school, letting them know either students or staff had tested positive during the holiday break. And just for context, up until the Christmas break, the school district itself had had 65 cases since the end of August, and they've had 44 just in the last week reported into them. So, yeah, the number that we saw from the state last week was over 1,300 cases on Thursday for the statewide. Dr. Levine was on your airwaves just last week talking to David Goodman, talking about how those numbers are now impacted by those rapid tests that people are getting.
Right.
And one of the things that's important is if people are doing those tests to report their results in, because the numbers that the state has are only as good as, you know, they're gathering that information.
Yeah, it's staggering right now. Lisa, you mentioned a little earlier the bond vote for the Harwood Union Unified District. And, wow, that went down to a big defeat. So let's talk about that. What's the plan now that the school bond was beaten in November?
Good question. You know, everybody's – I think people are kind of wondering what's going to happen next with that. And it's I think the answer right now is wait and see, because we're now going into budget season where school boards and select boards everywhere, right, in Vermont in January kind of get their budgets together that need to be finalized by the end of this month in order to be ready for the town meeting day votes. Town meeting day in this year is going to be March 1st. So they've kind of pivoted to working on their budget, and they have a superintendent search happening at the same time. And they've decided not – at this point, it doesn't look, I can't say they haven't decided for sure. They have several weeks here to pull this all together. It doesn't look as if the board is going to be putting any sort of, you know, pared back proposals out to voters for March town meeting. It looks like they may try to, they're discussing whether they want to pick off pieces of the projects that were included in that bond package to potentially include in this year's budget, maybe some of the more important pressing building needs. The whole point of the bond was to do some massive renovations and upgrades to Harwood High School, which hasn't really had that kind of a facelift in the 50-some years it's been around, and to add on to Crossbrook Middle School in order to merge the 7th and 8th graders, which are now in two schools. So the middle school merger is definitely on hold because that was kind of contingent on there being space at the Crossbrook School to fit them, and since that didn't get approved, that's just kind of waiting. But I think the bigger question now is what's the most pressing needs at the high school with their facility, and can they, you know, sort of focus on a few of those that they could include this year with the upcoming budget that they could address, and maybe, you know, take a bit of a piecemeal approach. The other piece that's part of the dynamic right now is the fact that the school board is 14 people, and 7 of those seats are going to be on the ballot on town meeting day.
Wow. And yeah, so there could be a lot of turnover. First of all, you talked about a superintendent search. So what's going on there?
So Superintendent Bridget Neese has been in our district now for, I think it's about 12 years. Her contract ends at the end of June this year, and she is not looking to renew it. She's looking to step down, retire. And so the school board has contracted with a search firm, a national firm from Nebraska that they hired back in the fall. And they right now are in the midst of their application process. In fact, I think today is the last day that applications are being accepted. And that's another big thing that's going to be happening here in January, where they will be looking at going through applications, weeding down the applicants to, you know, a handful of candidates to interview and then come up with finalists. And this whole process is going to play out now over the next several weeks, where they're hoping to have it completed to, in order to offer the job to someone by sometime in early February. There will be interviews done that will be accessible. The public will be able to watch some of that. They're looking to do some of this over Zoom online, that people will be able to watch and see who the final candidates are, et cetera. So that's another big job that they have right now, is to zero in on a candidate, make an offer, and then have that successor chosen in order to kind of do a transition between now and the end of June, when Superintendent Neese steps down.
Gosh, I was all ready to apply, but the idea of having to interview in front of a large Zoom audience, I think I'm going to pass on that.
And I think you only have until about 5 o'clock today to apply.
Oh, got to update that resume. Hey, now another thing that's happening is with the finance manager resigning. Is that right?
Yeah, Michelle Baker has been the finance manager for the district for, I don't know specifically, I bet it's been 10 years, if not more. She's been there for most of the time that Neese has been superintendent, and she's also looking to resign mid-year, too. So that's another big role that's going to have to get filled as well. So, you know, when you take in all that into consideration, right, there's going to be a new superintendent, a new chief financial officer for the district, and half of the school board, is up for election. And of those 7 seats on the school board, 5, I believe, have said that they are not running again. So there's going to be, you know, competition and new faces coming on board. There's going to be a whole new leadership team. It's going to look a lot different in just a few months. I think a lot of what the current group is thinking is that new group is going to be what's going to take things forward, and they're kind of leaving that up to them to sort of take the reins on what happens next.
I guess on the positive side, they all come in with a clean slate, with an idea of how to address what that $60 million school bond was trying to do, and maybe there will be some fresh and, new ideas that will resonate with people in the district.
Exactly. They're going to have a full plate and no shortage of big decisions to make. But it'll be interesting to see what a new group might put together, right? I mean, they may have some different approaches, some different ideas, and we'll see where that goes. It'll be interesting.
Another person who's retiring, and I remember people have always told me, never give any more than a 2-week notice, but apparently Municipal Manager Bill Shepelock didn't ever get that advice. He's giving a full year, I think even more than a year, about his retirement. He's going to retire at the end of 2022, at the end of this year. No, we're in 2022 now, all of a sudden. He has been an icon. What has he meant to the town of Waterbury?
Boy, it's funny that you say that he's giving his year's notice. Bill is a planner, Bill.
Yes, he is.
Looks ahead, and you cannot fault him for not, trying to look ahead and plan for things. And that's been kind of the hallmark, I think, of his tenure here as town manager. He's been here the entire time I've lived here. And he's always very methodical, and he's very careful to, sort of look at all sides of different issues and to come up with pros and cons. And he's very careful and deliberate. He's not he doesn't shoot from the hip kind of thing. And so he, in his trademark style, just right before the holidays, told the select board that, and he did this at a meeting with both the select board and the commissioners of the Water and Sewer District at a joint meeting, where he said he wanted to tell them all at the same time that he's going to be retiring at the end of the year, and he said, but it's next year. And so that gives him a full year to kind of plan for that transition, to do a search, of course, and to, potentially wrap up some of the things that he has, that he would like to see accomplished before he closes shop. But he's been a very steadfast leader here, and has had to really, you know, sort of roll with many of the punches that have come, especially in the last 10 years since Irene. That was probably the part that he talked about that night, saying that that was, you know, one of the most difficult times was when Tropical Storm Irene came and devastated our downtown, and just to try to pull all those pieces together. So it's, I think it's been rewarding for him to see things, you know, the recovery that's happened here in the years since. But it was a lot of work, and you know, there's a lot to show for it. And I think he feels like he's at a good point where it's time to sort of hand the reins over to someone new.
Yeah, and having watched from the media side of how he handled things in Waterbury during Irene, he was definitely one of the heroes in the state, people who stepped up and did incredible work. Now, he leaves with kind of proposals for recommended changes for the town structure. What is he recommending?
You know, one of the things that Waterbury went through a few years ago was that we used to have two municipal governments here. We had a village municipality and the town municipality. And for years, there was all this round and round that happened where, you know, there was discussions about merging them and, you know, this and that and duplication of services. And there was all that sort of churn that happened. And finally, it came together where the village essentially was dissolved. The biggest entity that it ran was the police department, and that was dissolved, and now the town contracts with the Vermont State Police for local police services. And so what was left is basically a water and sewer department. It's called EFUD, and it's the Edward Farrar Utility District, named after a long-ago, early 20th century official from the water department. But there's that municipality is basically a water district that has inherited some of the vestiges of the village government. And recently they were discussing how some property that's still owned by that entity should get transferred over to the town. There's parks like the Rusty Parker Park, the entire property down by the ice center, that whole tract down there is owned by the EFUD district. And a couple other little parcels here and there. And that got, Bill Shepelet talked about how that got him thinking about, you know, what's left and how to sort of structure local government. And he's got a proposal where he would envision eventually the water district not being its own municipality, but essentially basically just being a water and sewer department within town government.
Wow.
And along the way, the property that would, you know, that would come with it would be part of the town. There's some federal money that's now going to be coming into the community, just like every other community across America through the Recovery Act. Waterbury is going to be getting about $1.5 million. And some of that, he is looking at could help the utility district kind of get on good footing to make that transfer. And it might involve restructuring some debt that the ICE Center property has, with the town. But he's doing what Bill does. You know, he's looking ahead and he's trying to figure out, you know, what the best deal might be, to be able to leave things in good shape. And he sort of imagines that kind of being the last step to this, you know, this transformation that's happened from two entirely independent municipalities to, you know, sort of one, more consolidated, organized municipality that, hopefully would be more efficient.
We're going to have to leave it there. Lisa Scalotti, editor of the Waterbury Roundabout, and you can keep up with the reporting they do at waterburyroundabout.org. Also, you can hear Lisa's reports Monday afternoon on the afternoon news service. Congratulations on a great year and a half and many more, Lisa. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Rick. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. All right, this is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Warren Village is a picture-perfect snow globe this time of year. We invite you to visit us at the almost world-famous Warren store. Come for breakfast, lunch, or après-ski. Have a signature deli sandwich, a hearty soup, or a specialty coffee drink paired with a sweet treat from our incredible bakery. Upstairs is a cornucopia of delightful and unique finds from men's, women's, and children's clothing to gifts, toys, games, jewelry, hats, gloves, and scarves. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, according to Yankee Magazine. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
All right, this is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV, and, well, here we are with some time for you to share your thoughts. Phones are open, 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255, and the email address, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. I feel good. I always have them written in front of me, the phone numbers and email address, but it seems like I might actually have learned them in all this time. I do hope you got to hear some of our best of shows last week while I was off. Director Danny McGivrigan did an incredible amount of outstanding work to put those shows together. So a big thank you to him for the work that he does here. Now let's hear about your holidays, how they went, what, New Year's resolutions, if you have any. I wish I could tell you that I'm so perfect that I have no need to resolve anything, but I think the truth is that the list of things I need to change is so massive that correcting a few flaws will have absolutely no appreciable effect. So, yeah, it's that bad. So I have no resolutions to report for myself. I did get a great holiday at home with my family back in Pennsylvania and with friends here in Vermont. I do have a few stories that I want to read to you about some great people. And I do expect to get a call from a superhuman effort that he undertook this past weekend. But for now, you can call 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255, or email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. And it looks like we're going to start with Peter, who's calling us from somewhere. Oh, it's Peter Burke. Oh, Peter Burke from Cabot. How you doing, Peter Burke? Hey, when are you coming back on the show? We got to talk about winter gardening, don't we?
April, yes. Yeah, absolutely. I've sort of decided that it shouldn't be a New Year's resolution. It should be the same old New Year's resolution.
And what is the same old one that you resolve?
Oh, you know, it's the same old ones, you know. It's
I'm going to be better this year.
The exercise, it's the better eating, you know, all those things.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh. Yeah, just print them out. Yeah. Where was that one from last year? Oh, yeah, same one from the year
right,
before.
Right. Yeah, just, you know, you just make the list and reprint it every year.
That's right. And it's already the third, so some people have already probably, you know, already said, I'm not going to forget about it. I can't keep up with that.
One, yeah. Well, I had a wonderful holiday, actually. And you can imagine, as a parent, you know, having all five of my kids in one room at the same time, it's so rare.
Oh, man.
Yeah, that was just great. My son from New York, you know, just everybody came. So,
oh, Peter, that is so brilliant.
And I finally finished the book 2034. I think, I heard about it on your show. So I wanted to thank you for, you know, a great book. Again, you know, another great recommendation. Mm-hmm. And just thank you for your show. I just absolutely love it.
Well, Peter, thank you. Thank you for the show you do here on WDEV. And if you want to talk about winter gardening, you know, the indoor gardening at some point,
sure,
I'd love to have you back on. So,
all right, let's do it.
Okay, yeah, good.
Absolutely.
Oh, Peter Burke, it is great hearing from you. Thank you so much.
Happy New Year, my friend.
You too. Talk about a voice that brings joy. What a great way to ring in the new year, Peter Burke. Just love hearing from him. All right. Our numbers are 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. And I'm going to read a little. I've got a couple stories to read to you, and we'll see if we get to both of them. But this is about a hockey fan of the Seattle Kraken. I don't know if you heard this or saw this. But if you haven't, I'm just going to read a little bit about Nadia Popovici. I'm going to assume that's her name, Nadia Popovici. She hadn't woken up yet when what she had done to save a life was going viral on hockey Twitter. She's a 2019 University of Washington graduate, and she's about to go to med school. She worked at a crisis hotline overnight on New Year's Eve. And it was a shock to find out upon waking that she herself had become a story. She says, I woke up with my mom's phone call, and she was like, Nadia, you have no idea what's going on. She sent me the statement that the Vancouver Canucks put out, and it said they were looking for me. The Vancouver Canucks are looking for you. There was a lot of screaming. I couldn't believe it. Popovici, who goes to Seattle Kraken games, they're the expansion team in the NHL. She goes with her stepfather's season tickets, and she was the subject of a search from Vancouver Canucks assistant equipment manager Brian Red Hamilton, who said this past Saturday morning via a Twitter statement from the team, oh, this gets me, Papa Vici had saved his life. When the Canucks were at Climate Pledge Arena, which is the Seattle Arena, on October 23rd, the Kraken's home opener, Papa Vici, sitting behind the Canucks bench, typed a message out on her phone, knocked on the plexiglass, and got Hamilton's attention. And it read, and it wasn't just in text. You know, when you send a text, that little she made sure that it was on her screen, large enough for Hamilton to read. And it said, quote, the mole on the back of your neck is cancer. He had no idea that that he had this mole on the back of his neck. And he eventually went to a doctor and did indeed. They took, a biopsy, sent it off, and eventually it had to be removed. And he credits Nadia Popovici. What heads up, what brilliance, right? Sends him this message, sees it, you know, and she could have just forgotten about it, thought, ooh, that doesn't look good. But she sent a message that saved his life. He saw the message and kind of walked away, and she thought that he just kind of blew her off. And it wasn't until several months later that she found out, you know, everybody found out that he did indeed heed her message and had that mole taken care of, looked at and taken care of. So Nadia Popovici, oh, what a brilliant story. What a heartwarming story to start this new year. I'm going to hope this is the way our year goes. Now we have another person who I had on a couple weeks ago, and talk about, again, heartwarming and wonderful. I hope. I want to hear the results. Jesse Holden is on with us. Jesse, first of all, you're alive and well this January 3rd?
I am. Thanks for having me on again, Rick.
How are you feeling?
I feel good.
Yeah, all right.
I feel good. I'm still kind of in the – I've been telling myself that I really have to – I have to sit down sometime today or tomorrow and really write everything down and kind of reflect on the whole experience. But, yeah, no, I'm really good.
All right. So last year Jesse did a thing for 12 hours. This year, or I guess, you know, last year, he started on New Year's Eve into New Year's Day, went 24 hours. Jesse, explain to people what you were doing up there in the kingdom for 24 hours on New Year's Eve, New Year's Day.
Sure, yeah. I started at 3 o'clock on Friday, New Year's Eve, and I started to hike Mount Pisgah. In it, for the first about three laps, I was doing the entirety of the trail, which is from the south end to the north end and then back up and over. So you get two summits in about 8-point-something miles. And then as soon as I realized that people were going to be gone, I knew I was going to be by myself at some point, but when I realized people were leaving, the weather was pretty bad, so I kind of switched it up a little bit and decided that I would just summit from the south end just to the summit and down, because that's kind of like a 3.5 miles instead of the 8. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't be away from all of my clothes and food and water for as long. So I did that, and then I switched it up and did go down towards the north trailhead multiple times throughout the 24 hours. But yeah, I continued from 3 and to 3, and I ended up doing the whole thing. So I was moving for 24 hours.
Unbelievable. I kept thinking about you with, you know, 72 hours to go, with 48 hours to go, with 24 hours to go. I kept thinking, oh my gosh, what's this guy doing? Like, how is he preparing for what is a mammoth feat? Explain to people again why, Jesse, you were doing this.
Sure. Yeah. I was doing this as a fundraiser for Umbrella. Umbrella is our local domestic and sexual violence advocacy program. They do a ton of stuff up here in the Northeast Kingdom. And I really, really love their mission and what they do. And I guess my angle is more kind of like healthy masculinity, especially in athletes and young men. As a PE and health teacher up here in the Northeast Kingdom, that's kind of the way I tackle this issue. And so that's why, yeah, I was doing it for them and to raise awareness for this, for them and for this cause that I'm trying to shed more light on up here.
Oh, that's brilliant. Umbrella does a fantastic job in the Northeast Kingdom. Now, I know you set a higher goal than last year. Last I checked, you were a little below what you raised last year. So I hope that's climbing, but I want you to give people the address, how they can contribute, because what you've done is just staggering.
Oh, thanks, Rick. Yeah, so I'm a little below the goal still. I am going to keep the site, the GoFundMe, open until at least until after the local paper run. I think that they're going to run a kind of wrap-up article on the event and how it went. So I'm going to leave it open until at least after then, so probably through the week, I would say. And you can go to GoFundMe, and if you just search Rise Above Run, it will pop right up. You can also go to my Instagram, Jesse Holden Mountains. That has a link there as well. So those are probably the easiest ways to help out if you can.
So Katie Figenbaum doing another story on you in the Caledonian Record?
She is. She is. Good. And she was up there. Her and a contingent
kidding.
From her neck of the woods came up and were there for the end. So they kind of saw me through the last 45 minutes of my journey.
Jesse, hey, congratulations. I love what you're doing. And again, folks, you can go to GoFundMe and just search Rise Above Run and contribute to this great cause that Jesse Holden has really put out for 24 hours continuous movement. Way to go, Jesse. Congratulations. Happy New Year. Great having you back on.
Yeah, thanks, Rick. Happy New Year.
All right, take care. Again, go to GoFundMe, Rise Above Run. This was the first Christmas that my family had without either of my parents. My dad passed away in 2004, and my mom last January 7th. So I got to visit their grave while I was home. Do you all still do that? Why does that bring us that slight bit of solace as we try to recall the lives of our loved ones? We can talk about some positive effect that you had on someone over the holidays. I'd love to hear that. Also, Monday mornings, I'd like to start featuring a WDEV listener for a 15-minute spot at 9:45. You can nominate yourself or someone else. Email me, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com, or I'm just going to have to start enlisting some of you on my own. But please don't be shy. Again, our number is 244-1777, 877-291-8255. Next up, probably the person who had the most difficult week of their lives last week as we shut off the phones and it was all recorded, the Duke of Newbury, Fred, couldn't call in last week. I hope you made it through the week okay, unscathed, Fred.
Yeah, I barely made it.
Well, welcome back to the airwaves. What do you got, Fred?
Anyways, the thing that I'm fascinated by is who's going to have to pay the piper with all this money floating around in the economy. Mm. It looks like we're all going to have to pay the piper because the worst tax that can ever be put on anybody is inflation. That's going to kill everybody, the poor people, everybody but the rich people, because the rich people got the money to pay for inflation, but everybody else doesn't. This is unbelievable.
Well,
how are we going to solve the problem? Weimar Republic comes to mind.
Well, we've had inflation before. Now, this is a serious one, and, definitely it's, there's more money out in the economy chasing less goods right now, and so prices jump when that happens. We can only hope that the supply chain gets back up to speed at some point. And, we are in the middle of a pandemic that's lasting almost 2 years, so that certainly has put a crimp in our style, has caused these things. But, Fred, you have been raising this for about the last year. You saw it coming, and so I'll give you high marks for that. Not that you want it to be this correct, but you got it pretty well. But, you know, we go through inflation and then we've got to, you know, find ways to kind of decelerate. And that's now on the Biden administration to figure that out. So
I don't think we can do it.
Yeah, I mean, we can do it.
Well, build back better. That's a good one.
Well,
put more money into the economy. The more money the government pumps into the economy, guess what's going to happen? The more money's out there, prices are going to go up.
Yeah.
People are going to want more wages. We'd have a wage price inflation. I mean, that could never end. You know, the prices go up and the people want more money. I mean, this is, the Weimar Republic is what comes to mind.
I don't think I, you know, you're certainly, you know, allowed to express that opinion. I don't think it's quite as dire. We do have a robust economy. It's not crippled and things are certainly moving along, picking back up after, we had to slam on the brakes, if you remember, you know, just a year and a half ago. You know, there certainly is hiccups with shortages in staffing. People have found that they don't want to work for a low wage, Fred, you know, because of what it can mean. So people have jumped out of, you know, the machine. And at some point when the wage gets right for them or they, you know, can't afford to pay for goods, they will work again and the supply chain will pick up, you know, and then hopefully inflation does get, you know, checked. But you did raise this. I'm going to say, you know, Fred was right on this one. And so well done, Fred. But I don't think we're going to go the way of the Weimar Republic. I think you got that one wrong. You also said we'd have an uprising in October, and that one never happened. But we did have one last January, and, you know, we're going to talk about that this Thursday on the one-year anniversary of January 6th. Fred, thanks for calling. Always great hearing from Fred in Newbury, the Duke of Newbury, as we like to call him. All right, that should do it for today. Want to thank everyone who called in, and you know, we were getting, it was all positive stories until we got to Fred. But you know what? Dose of reality. A cold shower is not a bad thing, Fred. So I do appreciate your call and pointing that out. You've been pointing it out all along that this could happen. We do have to keep in mind that with a lot of money that needed for an economy that needed a boost. A jolt, maybe just too much. All right, that's it, Danny. We're going to put a cap on those open phones, call it a day. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivergan. Our email address, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. You can suggest topics or guests, and you can listen to past episodes and subscribe to our podcast at wdevradio.com. The podcast sponsored by the Warren Store, funky, friendly, and almost world famous. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre is up next. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here tomorrow.